But I think what's more important is the innate affinity that a person has, or like compulsion that they want to write. And that's almost more important than being able to string together a beautiful sentence, because having that drive, that need to write, writing is really about the mileage that you put into it. You only improve the more you write and the more you think about craft and the more editorial feedback you get. So you can write the most beautiful sentences in the world, but if you don't have the discipline or the urge to sit down and write every day, you will not be producing probably enough to really have a career that you can sustain.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Cheng, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence. Hey, what's up, Storyteller Tribe? You're listening to episode 67 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Cheng. Man, how about those election results this week? I'll be honest, I still feel numb. Yes, I am disheartened, but I'm even more saddened to see even more division happening right now. There's no other time where listening with clarity and respect is crucial to creating space for perspective-changing conversations and positive change. I spent hours going at it with my family members yesterday, and yelling didn't get us very far. It was only when a need for sharing, what's greater than the need to defend, came the light bulb moment where we were able to pinpoint the massive misunderstandings and move forward from there. Segregating ourselves by harboring anger and resentment leaves no room for understanding and progress. There are so many people asking what can be done from here on out. I urge you to start with conversations and personal stories. My dear friends and listeners, whether you're a writer, actor, director, producer, or whichever artistry you self-identify with, our stories are truly needed now more than ever. Don't stop creating. I see so much passion from you on your Facebook feeds, your Twitter, your Instagram, and blog posts. Use that to fuel your story so your audience has a chance to see what it's like to walk in your shoes. Now, before we head into today's interview, I wanted to thank Gotham Writers for sponsoring today's episode. They teach creative writing classes online and in New York City. They've built an awesome writing community, so be sure to hang around at the end of the show to find out why Gotham has earned an amazing reputation in the writer's world. Listeners, I'm thrilled to share today's episode with you. Alexandra Bracken is the number one New York Times and USA bestselling author of The Darkest Minds and Passenger series. Connecting with Alex was like catching up with a longtime friend. We immediately kick it off with talks about premonitions, past lives, witches, signs from the universe, and women's intuition. We then walk through how Alex first fell in love with writing and her experience in the publishing industry as an editorial assistant. We discuss how to discover story ideas for writing fiction and chat about her newest book, Wayfarer, which releases in January. We also dive into tips for writing under pressure, overcoming writer's block, character development, and building strong characters. Alex also shares how to develop a unique writing voice and how to write through emotional challenges. This is an episode packed with inspiring personal stories and actionable step-by-step advice for writers. We'll be doing a special giveaway for this episode. One lucky winner will receive a signed advanced reader's copy of Alex's newest book, Wayfarer. Be sure to sign up for our email newsletter for contest directions. Now let's jump right in. Hello.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, you sound absolutely lovely.
Cool. It's so nice to finally connect with you.
I know. It's so nice to speak with you finally. How are you?
I'm great. How are you? Are you excited for Friday?
Oh my God. I'm so excited. It's Friday. Hey.
Friday. Oh my gosh. I feel like this week has been so weird. Just
why?
In general. I don't know. I checked to see if Mercury was in retrograde.
Has something been off?
I don't know. I've noticed my family and I, we've just had weird, not bad luck, just weird things happen this week.
Was it like an accident or something?
Oh, no. Just like forgetting to do things or like breaking things, stuff like that.
You know what's weird? My girlfriend and I were on the way to the airport, and before that, we were about to visit one of these commercial spaces that she's looking into for her cafe shop that she's going to be opening.
Oh my God, that sounds amazing.
Thank you. The weird thing was, we were just driving on the highway. This was in LA before heading over to New York, and then we were driving like 62, 63, and then we see our exit. We're about to pull out, but the exit is still like half a mile ahead, so we're just on the very right lane. So we're just going with the flow, and then suddenly a car hits us from behind.
And it was, yeah, and it caused a 4-car pileup. It was
bad. Oh my gosh.
The cars behind us, because we were the very first ones, that the guy rammed into us, and then he caused the other two behind him to crash into each other, which they needed 3 ambulances, a stretcher, and the cars were totaled, absolutely totaled, glass everywhere, airbags were out, one of the passengers, or the driver, his leg was stuck or crushed underneath the dashboard area that got squished, and it was bad, and it was so weird, because our car looked like it got away with scratches and a dent. And the crazy part was the car that hit us from behind, he left. So he was a hit and run.
Wait, how did he manage a hit and run?
That's what I don't understand. Me and my girlfriend, we were in shock and we were calling the cops from inside the car. By the time we got out, he was gone. And we didn't even realize he was in the scene till the cops were like, there was a white car that hit you. It wasn't these cars that were totaled because they're black colored cars. But he's gone and he's most likely drunk or texting. So he fled the scene because he knew he would be arrested. It was so crazy. And then it was funny because you were talking about Mercury in retrograde. My girlfriend and I, we went to a party and someone at the party mentioned something about the moon and that it shifts and changes things, and we were like, maybe it's that.
Oh yeah,
you know,
wasn't there like, it was like a mega moon,
it was like the massive one.
Yeah.
And then so we're like, okay, maybe it's that. Oh, I mean, coincidentally, a lot of weird things have been happening for a lot of people, and it was just around that time of that moon. It could be possible. If things are acting up, I could definitely believe it.
Me too. I'm so glad you guys are okay, by
the way.
Oh
my gosh, thank you. I'm hoping that you guys are okay. I know you mentioned it's just things like you're like forgetting and stuff, but I hope it's like not important things that you needed for meetings. That's important too.
Nothing like that, thankfully. But it's been like this weird thing where I have a joke that my mom's side of the family is Greek, her maternal side. And so I have this theory that the women in her family come from a long line of Greek witches.
Oh my God.
That goes back to like Circe or something. Because my mom has premonitions about things.
I totally believe in that. I do. Because my mom's side of the family and my dad's side, I have aunts on both sides.
It's always the aunts.
It's always the aunts. They always have premonitions through dreams.
Yeah.
I absolutely believe in that. But that's so crazy. So your mom and then your mom's mom?
Yeah. When I was in college, I used to be able to predict pretty accurately exactly what professor would ask on tests, on finals.
Girl, and I should have studied with you.
I know. I'm sure some of it was really just studying and kind of getting a sense of what the overall themes were. It's probably not witchy intuition, but this past week I've noticed, and maybe it's the moon, I've noticed, this is a dumb example, I was opening my dog's allergy medicine and I was like, what if I accidentally flung this medicine everywhere? I should be careful. And then I flung the medicine everywhere. So I don't know if I'm just a split second anticipating doing something or if it's my brain that my hand hasn't caught up to my brain. I don't know.
That exists. That is out there. So don't question that. I think that's a gift and a talent. You know, I always wondered growing up with my hearing these experiences from my aunt, I always wondered if there was classes out there that would teach people born with these gifts to harness it and to make it strong. I mean, in real life, not just in books. I wish that there were classes out there like that. But I feel like they do have it. It's just kind of low key. And only people who really have the talent would find out about those classes. That's always like in my head. That's how I think.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Or it's somehow there's been like a breakdown. It used to be passed down from woman to woman. It was like our initiation into witchy womanhood. I think there's something to be said about the female intuition overall. I think a lot of women feel this way, that they just get very strong senses about things.
I mean, they're always the one who catches the significant other. They know if they're either not being faithful or doing something shady behind their back. They always say, always trust the wife's intuition. I absolutely believe it. Also, the mom's intuition is always the strongest.
Oh, yeah.
They know what you have been doing. It's like they have a camera following you around or something. It's insane.
I know. My mom, I swear, sensed when my brother got into a car accident. She felt like very unsettled the whole night. And thankfully, it wasn't like a major accident or anything. But
oh my God, I'm so sorry.
She was just like, I don't know. I just don't feel good. This was years ago. It really was not a big accident, but she just felt like very unnerved that entire night, which I thought was so interesting. So do you believe in past lives too? I've been thinking about this a lot recently.
Yes, I do. Also because my family raised me as a Buddhist. So, I mean, they're fully Buddhist and I'm still trying to figure that out for myself. But we very much believe in past lives, reincarnation, karma. trauma and all that. Well, my family does. So I absolutely understand it.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot too, because I've been trying to come up with this story that utilizes it. This is sort of my random, everyone always asks, where do you get your ideas from? And really it's random things like this. Like I want to write a book about past lives or feeling like you've had a past life. It was inspired by, I love going to see psychics. A lot of people think it's a waste of money. I think it's really interesting. And sometimes it's therapeutic where you really can talk it out a little bit. Even if they're really just functioning as a mirror, like you need someone that's impartial to be like, stop doing this, whatever yes. you're doing.
Yes.
I lived in New York for 6 years and I was really struggling with the decision about whether or not I wanted to move out of New York City and where I wanted to move to because I wasn't quite ready to move back to Arizona where I finally just moved back earlier this year. So of course I asked a psychic, you know, on the fly. I was like, where do you see me? Where do you think I should move to? And so I grew up in Arizona, born and raised. There is no reason why I should be obsessed with colonial and Revolutionary War history in America. We didn't even learn about it until I was in high school. I went to school at the College of William & Mary in Virginia, which is in Colonial Williamsburg. So I felt this weird affinity for studying history, especially that time period. And I love Virginia. I love it like I grew up from there. And I really love Charleston, too. It's something about that region of the country I feel an affinity for. And so I mentioned that to the psychic and she was like, well, you probably lived a past life there and it was probably one of the good lives.
Oh my God, I just got goosebumps. I got happy goosebumps. I mean, I don't even know if that's a real thing to have happy goosebumps, but I usually get goosebumps when I hear about other people's past life stories because it's usually violent. I have a friend who, there's this sound bath where you ring a gong and it's supposed to cleanse your thinking and your spirit. People usually find it relaxing, but for that specific friend, she would get intense, almost post-traumatic stress as if she just came out of a war. No joke, as if she just came out of a war or she was in war. And it would freak her out like crazy. And she always is very sensitive about her neck. So she also saw a psychic. And that psychic said that her past life, she got killed because she got, I think it's beheaded or something.
Oh, either
beheaded or it was like shot in the head. It was like the upper area was very, yeah, it freaked me out. And I absolutely believe that.
It's like cannon fire.
Yes, yes. And that sudden bang, that thud. So for hers, it was a scary one. But for yours, when you realize you had a positive tie to your past life and it wasn't sad, usually I hear sad or scary ones. But this one was cool where the psychic was like, that was probably your best life was in Virginia. So that's so cool.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting to think about. And also, I'm scared to death of the ocean. I don't like
me too.
Even sticking my feet in. I don't know if it's because I grew up in the desert. So I just have like a very deep suspicion of dark water.
I'm really deathly scared of water. But I'm not to the point where I won't dip my feet in. I will go in as much as I can, but I have extreme fear of drowning. My uncle joked around and tried to drag me under the water in the pool one day when I was
not
a kid.
Cool.
Well, I didn't know how to swim. It's possible that one of our past lives could have drowned, or maybe one of our loved ones drowned and maybe instilled that fear in us.
Yeah. I think maybe we were in a shipwreck, because I don't think people who sailed on the tall ships get enough credit for how absolutely terrifying. It just was such a dangerous thing to do, and humans somehow mastered it for the most part, but they were always at the mercy of the ocean and storms. It's just a really interesting, terrifying thing to think about. I don't even really like going on cruises or sailing.
That is funny. Okay, sailing I haven't tried. I would actually love to try that, but cruises, I'm not a fan. I always feel like I'm trapped.
Yeah, it doesn't help too that all of the cruises recently in the news have been people vomiting over the side of the rails and getting sick.
In a cruise where it made huge news, the husband pushed his wife off of the back of the ship.
Wait, while you were on
he
the ship?
He pushed her off, so he murdered her. I think they were saying it was definitely pre-planned because he so happened to push her off in the territory where it was difficult to figure out, so they couldn't really put him in trial for a while. So it was very interesting. I was like, oh, that's so creepy.
That snake.
I know. And he was quarantined in one of the rooms for the rest of the trip because they had to escort him right to the FBI police officers. So that was so freaky. But you know what scares me too is at night when you look outside on a cruise ship, I cannot take it. I will freaking die. I get so scared.
Me too.
So girl, I feel you.
I genuinely believe this stuff. Also, have you read Tina Fey's Bossy Pants?
I have not, but I heard it's really good. And I heard she did a great audio version too.
I actually listened to the audio version when I was driving out into the wilds of West Virginia to pick up my dog. But she has a story about how she and her, I guess her husband, if I'm remembering this right, is really scared of flying. So they decided for their honeymoon that they were going to take a cruise, except I guess their cruise ship had some major problem happen, like a 2 or 3 bell emergency, which is really bad.
What?
And she was talking about how the performers, they're the ones that are in charge of the lifeboats. And I guess they get armed and they're allowed to shoot any passenger who is not cooperating with rescue and emergency efforts.
You're kidding me. Are you serious?
No. I think there's this whole crazy world of cruise ships that most people don't know. So now I'm like, I don't want to take a cruise ever.
Holy crap. This is taking a turn in the darker road, but I hear that also there's a lot of rape cases in cruise ships.
People go missing on cruise ships all the time. Young women especially get smuggled off.
Yeah, sex trafficking.
Yeah, sex trafficking. So it's, I mean, ugh.
I would never let my sisters go alone. Absolutely not. If they wanted to do like a sister thing, I'd be like, oh, hell no, you are not. I refuse, because you just never know. That was so fun, just getting to know more about you and about each other. I'd love to know how you fell in love with writing and why do you write?
I can actually pinpoint it. It was when I was in third grade, my teacher, Mrs. Weiler, had us sit down and write short stories that we would illustrate, and then she stapled them together, and then she bound them in cardboard and contact paper and made little books out of them for us. And I still have one of mine. It's on my YouTube channel. It was about the story of how the asteroid belt was formed, and it's fully illustrated. I invented a new planet. So I think what it was, though, at that age, I really loved reading more than anything. I was a huge Roald Dahl fan. And I think I always thought, well, if it's this fun to read, it must be this fun to write. The somewhat unique thing is that I knew from a really young age that I wanted to write children's books. I didn't want to write books for adults, which at that time I was like, oh, those books sound boring. They're just about people being bored and sad, which, you know, not actually a bad description of a lot of literary adult fiction. No offense, adult fiction. And it also helped too that my dad, before he passed away, was a big Star Wars collector. We would go to conventions. The stuff was always around. We were always watching the films. And so from a really young age, first grade, I was introduced to the very classic hero's journey and kind of internalized that a little bit. And then when I was in middle school, I started reading fan fiction, because middle school was about when the internet came about, or we got dial-up internet. Did you ever have dial-up internet?
The days of AOL and AIM. Oh my gosh.
Those were the times where you had to have a fax line, or you would have to take over your home phone line, and your parents could always bust you when you were staying up too late, and only one person could be on the internet at a time.
Yes, I remember that.
I would print off fan fiction stories and read them at night instead of actually being online. So then I started writing fan fiction. I wrote fan fiction all the way through college, basically. And
wow.
My freshman year of college was the first time I ever tried to write an original novel. I'd written a lot of really melodramatic poetry just throughout middle school and high school. And then when I was in college, my freshman year, I decided I wanted to try NaNoWriMo or NaNoWriMo.
I'm doing NaNoWriMo this year for the first time.
Oh my gosh, good luck. Have so much fun.
Thank you. I'm so excited, but very nervous at the same time. But I think I'm going to pants it. I'm just going to go with the last thing I wrote about like 2 years ago or a year ago, and then just take it from there and just see how it goes. My gosh, that's awesome. You did NaNoWriMo as well. And I'm one of those who say NaNoWriMo.
Okay.
I'm like, okay, it's National Novel Writing Month. Rye, yeah. From writing. So that's why I think Remo sounds super cute, but for me, I just can't help it, but I just say RIMO. Sounds like rhino.
I don't know. It like does something to it.
That's awesome. So you did that.
Yeah, I wrote that book, and I actually tried querying it. This was 2005, and I submitted it to every agent that was in the business at that time, and I became really, really fascinated by the culture of children's books. That at the time, Twilight had really just come out, and Harry Potter did so much for children's literature. It broke it off of the New York Times list and gave us a dedicated list of our own. It brought so much attention to the world that had always been very rich and very sweet and very lovely, and kind of expanded it into what it is today. But Twilight really was the instigator for the YA world that we have now. And so Twilight had really just come out. I always feel like I got into the YA world at the exact right time. It was a good matter of timing, in that there still weren't that many people querying agents. People were looking for all different types of stories. And so my first book went nowhere. It will live forever on my hard drive. Hopefully no one will see it. I'm going to put it in my will to have that story.
Oh gosh, now I'm even more curious.
It was really just that I think I word vomited every imaginable fantasy cliche. I hope I got it all out of my system in one go. So I was really discouraged because I got like 100 rejections for that story, but I loved writing. And at that point I had gotten into the habit of writing, and I still had this somewhat naive hope that I would be able to become a published author straight out of college. And I would be able to do that because my parents, my dad especially, were really encouraging me to go to law school, already making escape plans from being a lawyer. Like, oh, I'll work just long enough to pay off my student loans and then I'll write. And I was like, well, what I really want to do is write. I knew at that point that even if I sold a book, I would have to have a day job most likely for many years before I would feel comfortable writing full time. I was discouraged after my first book did not sell. So I finally hit upon another high fantasy story idea that was inspired by me narrowly missing a very rare snowstorm in Arizona, in central Arizona, because it snows all the time in northern Arizona. I got back to William & Mary in my dorm room and I was like, God damn it. I was so mad I missed the snow. It also doesn't snow in Williamsburg, Virginia for the most part, or at least not that often. Maybe now it does more, thanks to global warming. So I kind of got this idea of this girl who was cursed, and that was the reason why her desert homeland wasn't getting any rain, and it wouldn't get rain until she left. So it sort of sparked this cute fantasy idea that I then became obsessed with. And I wrote my first book, Brightly Woven, for my friend Carlin, who had edited that first failed novel. I was writing it for her birthday, which to me felt like less pressure because I was writing it for a friend that I really loved versus writing it for publication. I was only done with half of it by the time her birthday rolled around. And then I finished it and I was like, I feel really good about this. Again, how we were talking earlier about intuition. I really love this book. I really love these characters. I started it my junior year, and then my senior year, I was editing it, and I submitted it to agents again, and I actually got an agent who has now since left the industry. She was with my same agency that I'm with now, so when she left, I kind of just got adopted by another agent. We must have revised it for 5 or 6 months. We revised it for a really long time. It basically went from the middle of first semester into February or March of second semester senior year. And I would get up every single morning at 6 o'clock and I would go buy my breakfast of a bottle of Coke. Until recently, I did not like coffee. So when I needed caffeine, I would always drink a Coke.
I hope you kicked that habit because Coke is so bad.
I'm trying to get over it. It really is actually an addiction. Oh, when God. I need my go-go juice, quoting Honey Boo Boo there, it's like Mountain Dew, which is even worse.
That is so funny. I have one of my really dear close friends. She is addicted to Coke. We just came together for our friends since middle school. One of them just got married this past weekend. We were like, do you want to get a drink? We're going to go grab a cocktail right now. What do you want to drink? And she's like, oh, I'll have a Coke. I'm like, still? You still want a Coke after all these years? Since we were like 13.
So bad. I actually do think it's an addiction.
It is.
I've noticed that even when I drink coffee, which is a crap ton of caffeine, yeah. I still want a Coke. Oh, so I think it's the taste of it, or it's the sugar content or something that the coffee is not doing it. Now I'm in a phase where I'm trying to wean myself back off it, but it gets really hard when I'm on deadline and I feel like I need an extra boost of energy and focus.
It's like smoking.
Yeah, and the withdrawal is really bad. I've quit a couple of times and the withdrawal has knocked me out, which is a sign that I really should probably.
Yeah, girl, I'm like, I think we need to give you an intervention right now. So, or at least after your deadline, we'll have to give you an intervention.
Speaking of signs from the universe.
Yes.
Let me finish the story really fast before I get onto this because it's somewhat related. So I would get up every single morning. I still can't listen to Arcade Fire's Keep the Car Running because that was my alarm at the time. So whenever I hear that song now, it makes me feel very nostalgic. We sold Brightly Woven my senior year of college. And then I ended up working in the publishing industry after college. And so this is what I was referencing before. I was really, really strict with myself because I wanted to have my day job. And I loved working in publishing. I did not want to give my jobs up. But I also needed time to write. Every Friday, I really only wrote on the weekends. I would start at like 6 p.m. Friday. I would buy my dinner and then stop by the CVS on the corner and buy 3 bottles of Mountain Dew. And then walk home and work pretty much until 3 or 4 a.m. Wow. Would go to sleep, wake up at 9 a.m., would work the entire day on Saturday, stay up until 3 or 4 a.m., go to sleep, and then repeat on Sunday, except I would go to bed at a reasonable hour. But I really, it was bad. I do need to get off soda.
I'm thinking, are there any doctors I can recommend to you that can really help advise or nutritionist?
I think I need to be hypnotized.
I heard that really works with smoking, and I heard that it really works with any food addictions.
The sign from the universe that I was talking about earlier, I was in CVS, minding my own business, selecting my Mountain Dew bottle. A kid who was lingering nearby, who clearly had been told by his grandmother that he could not have a soda, he saw that I was getting a Mountain Dew and he looked at me and was like,
you're going to rot your teeth out. My grandmother said it will stain your teeth brown.
Oh, I was like, this is the voice of God. He's telling me to stop drinking Mountain Dew. Except then I bought the Mountain Dew and drank it anyway. What he was describing actually reminded me of the anti-drug commercials that they used to air in Arizona that like, scarred me for life and have pretty much ensured I will never try drugs. The campaign, I think it went national. I don't know if it started in Arizona or we just adopted it, but the slogan was tobacco, tumor-causing teeth staining, smelly puking habit. There was a commercial with Busy Phillips, who you all might remember, the actress, who got like dumped into a trash can because she tried smoking at a concert. And there was another one that they had to put a parental advisory on because it showed a girl smoking. Her skin was peeling off in chunks. Her hair was falling out. I was deeply traumatized by these incredibly effective ads.
Oh my God, that's so creepy.
It looks like the Crypt Keeper.
I'm shocked that they actually can air that on national television. You know, the smoking cartons, they used to have those warning signs, but they're not allowed to really show graphic photos now, but they do in Asia. And I forget that because when I'm traveling around, the photos in Asia, oh my God, it scared the hell out of me. They show the actual insides of it rotting. I was gonna puke. It does work though. It really does sometimes make you think twice. I am really curious. You're a full-time author right now. But before that, you were in the children's book publishing world in New York. What was that like?
I have to start the story by saying that my dad desperately wanted me to be a lawyer. And I'm such a people pleaser. I never want to disappoint anyone.
Aww.
So I really went through the motions that I was going to go to law school. I even went to take the LSAT. Halfway through taking it, I looked up and was like, I don't want to be a lawyer. What am I doing here? I don't want to be a lawyer. I don't want to pay the tuition. And it was right around the time that the 2008 recession started. So everyone I went to school with was going to law school. And I knew it would be really hard to find a job. You couldn't score high enough to get into one of the really good law schools. My brain, for some reason, does not process logic very well. Even when I was younger, when I would take math tests, I would try to maneuver around the logical solution to arrive at the answer. And sometimes my teacher would give me points for trying to figure out a different method. For some reason, I think I'm a very creative thinker and my brain just does not process information the way the LSAT needs you to. So I knew I was already going to be not scoring that well. And I knew that my heart wasn't in it, which also was a reason I was not scoring well on my practice test. I was in a funk. I don't think it's exaggerating to say I was in a depression between the summer between junior and senior year because suddenly I didn't have a plan and I hadn't sold a book yet and I didn't know what I was going to do with myself. So I went to the Career Center, which I recommend if you feel adrift and you're in college. I went to the Career Center and utilized that resource. And I went over my resume with them and I was talking to them about, like, well, I don't really have that much internship experience. What should I do? And William & Mary, which I later found out was because a ton of people from William & Mary actually worked in the publishing industry or still work in the publishing industry, they had a scholarship to attend one of the publishing courses, the summer publishing courses. There's one in Columbia, there's one at NYU, there's one at Denver. Basically, you could apply to do this program, which was perfect for me because I didn't have any internship experience in publishing, even though that senior year of college, I felt like I wanted to have some sort of experience related to that. So I interned with one of the offices at school and wrote like press releases and got a feel for publicities and marketing. And so I did the Columbia Publishing course, which was really fun. It's like a very intensive program that's a couple weeks. You go and you live at Columbia, you sit through a bunch of different lectures from people who work in the industry. You do publishing boot camp where you join with a group of others and you form your own imprint and you come up with fictional titles and you do the profit and loss statements for them. You design the covers for them. It was really fun. And obviously the important part of it is that there was a whole network of alumni from that program. And a lot of the publishing companies hire directly out of those programs. Publishing is still kind of an old boy network where it's really who you know. So if you're interested in getting into publishing out of college, major, changing careers into publishing. My best, most important recommendation is you go through your acquaintances, you go through your alumni network, and you find someone to send your resume to that is not the HR website. One of the HR people I interviewed with told me that a couple thousand people had applied for this one job through the job website. And really, I got the job because it was a friend who already worked at the company had passed on my resume.
Wow.
You need someone to vouch for you. I think that's why there's been a little bit of an issue with the fact that publishing on the career side is very white, very female. There's a lot of work to be done on that front, I think. I knew during the program that I did not want to be an editorial assistant, and those jobs were the rarest. It's the job that everyone wanted because, you know, that's the job that everyone knows. I didn't want to be an editorial assistant because I knew, based on informational interviews and listening to the speakers at the program, that when you're an editor, you do most of your editing and you do most of your reading, like submissions or reading drafts, do it at home. So it's really like a lifestyle choice, almost more than it is a job. So I was like, oh, I think I'm going to try to do marketing and publicity, because I sold my first book and I wanted to be able to write and have a more typical 9-to-5 and have a better life balance. So naturally, the first job I get offered is as an editorial assistant at a children's publishing imprint. So I worked as an editorial assistant. And let's just say that going from ye olde Colonial Williamsburg to living in Manhattan was a huge adjustment. I was so, so happy. I'm very introverted. So being around that many people and writing this, it's very overwhelming. And I had been warned by a bunch of people that it takes 2 to 3 years to really acclimate to living in New York City. And I think that's true. 2-3 years is about when you have a really good grip on the subway system. You can get yourself around. You don't feel unnerved walking around at night. You kind of are absorbed into the big chaos that's New York City. But my first couple years, I was so miserable. I was determined not to ask my parents for money. You do not make that much money when you're an assistant in publishing, even. I think my first job was $30,000 before taxes. And taxes in New York are insane. It really was living on a very small income. I was the total cliche of eating ramen noodles 3 days a week. My fancy dinner, as I used to call it, was oriental flavored ramen noodles that I would mix with sauteed celery and onion. And that was my fancy dinner that I would have. And I would still get down to $5 or $3 even at the end of the month.
How much was your rent? It's freaking crazy in New York City.
Yeah, it's insane. It's even worse now, which is actually one of the reasons why I ended up moving recently out of it. I finally got priced out.
It's like a freaking closet for $3,000-$4,000.
It warped my standards so much. My mom started looking for a place for me before I moved back. And she was like, well, what's on your wish list? And I was like, this might be too much. So if it's even just one of these, I'll be so happy. I'd really like a closet in my bedroom. I would like a kitchen that has drawers in it, because I've had 2 or 3 in New York that did not have any drawers because they were so small. I was like, I'd like the floors to be even so I don't have to fear my bookshelf falling on me. Things like that. She's like, I think we can manage this.
And then you ended up getting like a house for half the price of New York City.
Yeah, exactly. My mortgage payments are less than my rent payments when I lived in a one-bedroom apartment that was pretty much almost in Harlem on the East Side. When I first moved to New York, though, in 2009, it was right after the recession. I lived in a big complex called Stuyvesant Town. Stuytown is in the East Village, kind of an alphabet city. So my cross street were Avenue C and 16th. And for people who don't live in New York, L train services Williamsburg. So they used to call it like the hipster express. It was always packed. I usually ended up walking several avenues to get on the train at Union Square at 14th Street instead of trying to catch the L train unless it was really cold out. So that was my first apartment. I shared with 2 girls. We converted a 2-bedroom apartment to a 3-bedroom apartment, which shortly thereafter became illegal. At that time, a lot of people had left New York because of the job situation was bad. The economy was depressed. So we got a great deal. And then slowly but surely, like, rent prices kept going up and up and up and up. One of our roommates decided she was going to move to Portland. And so she was subletting the studio. It was really teeny. It was short ways away while my other roommate and I moved to the Upper East Side, which surprises people, but is probably one of the last affordable neighborhoods within Manhattan that you can live in. So obviously there are the beautiful gorgeous homes and buildings that are west of Lexington. Anything east of Lexington gets a lot more affordable, and the Upper East Side tends to be a little bit cheaper than the Upper West Side because it's only serviced by one subway line, and they're building the Second Avenue subway, so you're also dealing with construction noise. By the way, the Second Avenue subway, I'm convinced, will never be done in my lifetime.
I'm pretty sure it's not. Yeah, I agree with you.
So my rent in my first apartment, I feel like it was split between three people. My rent was still $900, and then when they increased the price the next year, it went up to $1,100. At my next apartment with just one other person, it was $1,200 a month, and that didn't include any utilities. So it was really expensive on a very small publishing salary. I'm not trying to discourage people if this is your dream at all, but just so people are aware, people do this all the time. You can do it. Believe in yourself. You're a woman your first year or two.
You were doing that for 6 years, right?
Yeah. I mean, it got better. I sold the Darkest Mind series and had more of a safety net and could spend a little bit more money.
Oh my gosh.
But that didn't happen until 2011, maybe. So I had about 2 years of trying to desperately make it work. I ended up writing The Darkest Minds because I was so unhappy.
You were able to still find time to write that.
I'm not going to sugarcoat it. When I was an editorial assistant, my boss, who I think is a genuinely really nice, lovely person outside of the office, she was very old school, a little bit of a dragon lady, super demanding and exacting, was not super forgiving of mistakes, always was prone to making you feel like you were on the verge of being fired for something. So she used to be the head of another publisher who I think then got acquired by this publisher, because that's sort of what has happened over the years. A lot of the smaller publishing houses have been absorbed and come imprints at the bigger five or six that are out there now. Here's an example. If I could get through the week without crying in the bathroom a couple times, that was a good week. And to cheer myself up, I still like joke about this, but I would have Chipotle Thursdays. So this is what I look forward to every week. I would leave the office like 6 or 7, go home and have enough money to buy my $9 or $10 burrito bowl. And then I would take it home on Thursday and would watch Thursday night television. And that was like what I looked forward to. So for instance, the story I always like to tell is that the editorial assistants used to rotate who would do the ordering for the different supplies that we would need. So one month it was my turn and I asked my boss, what do you need me to order for you? Do you need any pens? Do you need any post-its, etc.? And so she showed me this pen that she really liked that I guess she had stolen from another editor. So I ordered a whole pack of them. She had taken one of the pens that I had ordered for her and she had wrapped a post-it note around it. So clearly she had found a different pen to use in this situation because she wrote a note on the post-it note that said, of what use is this pen? And so I took it back to my desk and I called one of my friends over and I was, what does this note mean? Of what use is this pen? She didn't realize that the pen had one of those gel tips on it to keep the ink from leaking. So I walked back into her office and I was like, all you have to do is take the gel tip off. She at least started laughing because she was embarrassed, but I was like, oh, I gotta get out of here. There were parts of being an editorial assistant I actually really loved. We would rotate taking notes each week in the editorial and acquisitions meetings. So I learned pretty quickly in my time there exactly how subjective publishing can be and reader taste is, just listening to the comments the different editorial directors would make. And there's sort of an interesting dynamic between all of the different imprints, very competitive, but also trying to support each other. And the publishing house that I worked at was fostered kind of a spirit of competitiveness. We were forced to have these brown bag lunches as all the junior editors, so assistant editors and editorial assistants, and even sometimes the editors themselves. We would go and hear from different department heads. And I remember the editor-in-chief one day sat us, all the assistants, down. She opened this lunch with, look around the table. All of these girls are your competition. What? And I remember thinking, I was like, these are my friends.
Why would they say that? Oh my gosh.
In a way, it's true in the sense that at that point, they were finally letting agents submit projects to multiple editors in-house. There was this sudden additional feeling of competitiveness to acquire projects that people thought were very commercial and would sell well, etc. So, but at that point, I had applied for a job in marketing a friend of a friend basically had sent this job application over and was like, I think you'd be a good fit for it. I ended up moving to Random House Children's Books in school and library marketing. Mm-hmm. The school and library marketing was so interesting and so fun because it involved a lot of travel. We would go to all of the different educator and librarian conferences, and you know, I would work the booth and not hand sell, pitch books to different educators who were looking for book on studies that they were doing or focuses. And we would work with educators to come up with educator guides for different books. And I did a lot of advertising, and I learned a lot about what's called author care, which is the idea of treating your authors very well and Aww. Making sure there's care of and they don't feel like they're lost when they go to events. It's making sure you're there to spin if they're in an awkward situation. I worked there for, oh my gosh, how long did I work there for? Almost 5 years. I was like a little shy of 5 years. I really loved that job, and I was making it work when I was writing the Darkest Mind series, and I really did not want to leave because I loved my boss. I loved my friends there. I just genuinely worked. But it got to the point where I could not keep up with it anymore. I had really tough deadlines I had to make for the Darkest Mind series. And then we were traveling so much. I really admire authors who can work while they're on the road, but I have to sit down and focus on something and not interrupt it. I eventually gave my notice. And at that point, I felt okay doing it because I had remembered that my newer agent who had adopted me, she had told me that you know you can write full-time when you're either selling a book a year, roughly, or you have a book coming out each year, so you're guaranteed of, like, on publication payments, on delivery payments, etc., or you're earning royalties. So I honey saved up. I was really locked in a debate about whether or not my lease was coming up on my apartment at that point. And I was like, do I stay in New York or do I move home? This deadline is coming up very quickly. What do I do? So I ended up staying in New York and wrote full time in New York for a year, which was really fun. It's like kind of lived like a monk. Writing full time is, I'm so grateful I can do it. I am scared, to be completely honest, I'm scared all the time that it could go away and I'll have to get another day job. And that'll be fine. I enjoy working. Sometimes being a full-time writer can be lonely if you're not finding your author friends to chat with throughout the day. It's so nice. I get to travel so much more now. And so over the past year, really, I've gotten to know a lot of other authors who we always joke are like on the circuit. We go to the same festivals. I've gotten to know so many authors this year who have become really good friends of mine. And I'm so excited because Y'all Fest is coming up really soon. I'm like, my people, I haven't seen you since Y'all West.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome. I think that's so cool. It sounds like you didn't take any writing classes. It sounds like you did this all yourself and you're self-taught.
Yeah, sort of. I did take one class when I was in college. I'm a William & Mary stan, as I always say. There's so much good stuff about that school. I really struggled a little bit. I was a history and English double major. The history department there is phenomenal. It is top-notch, especially if you love early American history. Like, moi.
Like you. Yes, girl.
My freshman seminar was an all-day Saturday class. We would take historical field trips around Tidewater, Virginia. And that was my heaven. It was so fun. I love that class. And I volunteered to take that all-day Saturday class. And then I write essays afterwards about all the places we visited and the themes. It was so fun. But I struggled a little bit more with the English department because I felt in some ways, the professors obviously are wonderful, but I felt like the course offerings weren't that flexible. It was very traditional. So it wasn't like they didn't really have classes on children's literature. They had, I think, a freshman seminar on it, maybe a little bit more rigid in terms of the class options, a lot of focus on 20th century British literature. For some reason, those were the only classes I could get into. So I ended up reading the same books over and over again for different classes. I took one writing class, which was actually a nonfiction writing class that I thought was really interesting. But that was really it.
I feel like that barely counts. So did you end up writing and you had friends who were able to give great feedback and critiques that you could learn from? Or you just are also like an avid reader where you learned how to put together stories and string them together and find strong voices and dialogue by reading other books?
It's interesting because I think there's maybe innate talent, but I think what's more important is the innate affinity that a person has, or like compulsion that they want to write. And that's almost more important than being able to string together a beautiful sentence, because having that drive, that need to write, writing is really about the mileage that you put into it. You only improve the more you write and the more you think about craft and the more editorial feedback you get. So you can write the most beautiful sentences in the world, but if you don't have the discipline or the urge to sit down and write every day, you will not be producing probably enough to really have a career that you can sustain unless you hit it really big with your first book. I think a huge part of it for me was writing fan fiction. Mm-hmm. And it was having that feedback from readers, getting a sense of what sort of plot twists work. But also, I love fan fiction because it feels like a safe environment to develop your own writing voice, because you're working a safe and useful, I should say, where you're free of judgment. I mean, people will give you feedback, but it's not like if you want to play, they're not going to destroy you. It doesn't affect a career. You know, if you get a bad review as a published author, you're like, everyone sees this. It's like having a big award on your face. What if I never sell another book? There's a whole comes with being a published author and getting a bad review versus getting bad feedback on fan fiction, where you can learn from the mistake and then literally go in and edit that chapter. I like fan fiction because you can very much focus on one aspect of storytelling to work on. You can focus on writing a very character-driven story and playing with those existing characters. You can learn about creating a plot arc. You can teach yourself about writing the interaction of character and setting. So I think writing fan fiction and just actually building up a writing muscle, where I was sitting down and writing like a chapter a week constantly, it wasn't unusual for me to have a date with writing.
Yeah.
Where I sit down and work and work and work and would feel proud of publishing that. And, you know, it was funny though, because I remember when I sold my first book, Brightly Woven, the editor that I worked with on that book was like, you are naturally inclined to writing a serialized story. I always write too much plot in my books, which probably explains why they're so long.
They're so awesome, you mean?
Thank you. It's almost like writing for TV, where you're writing, it's too episodic versus writing that one big, coherent, beautiful plot arc. And so that, I think, came from writing fan fiction, which is like every chapter is a huge cliffhanger and you're kind of writing little bundles of story plots and arcs. So I had to really then, with the help of my editors, teach myself how to write a coherent big plot, be a lot more thoughtful and careful with my storytelling. And it's interesting because only recently I feel like I've started reading craft books. Before, I was always scared that it would somehow mess with my method. I don't know what I was scared of, because actually it's been super useful. For instance, I talk to two of my friends, Aaron Bowman and Susan Dennard, all the time about craft things, and we share books that we really like and kind of go back and forth with brainstorming. Recently, the book that Susan, I feel like Susan gets credit for finding it or discovering it and sharing it with us, but the book that we're obsessed with is John Truby's The Anatomy of a Story.
Yes, I have that book and it's so useful. It's really fantastic. It's a great how-to. It's a very great how-to.
Yeah, and you can actually use the lessons. He actually breaks down how you can implement all of this stuff. And it's great for any sort of fiction writing, whether that's novels or short stories or even writing a script or screenplay. And then the other, it's kind of an intense book though. So if you're kind of new to maybe reading craft books, save that one until you're a couple books in and you kind of get a feel for reading them, because sometimes they can feel very dry and overwhelming and it takes you a couple reads to really absorb them.
That's a good
point. I really also like Martha Alderson's books. The one that really resonated with me was The Plot Whisperer. Yeah, and I really like her book Writing Deep Scenes too. Some people might not like this, but I thought it was interesting. She kind of also has a very philosophical take on the life of a writer too and how that's intertwined. So it's great. I highly recommend both of those books. And it's been really helpful to me. I think, honestly, the more you write, the more you should be paying attention to craft and learning from past mistakes and figuring out where your weaknesses are and trying to really fix them. And obviously, my first drafts are garbage. They are not good. Even when I think they're amazing, I'll come back and reread them later and be like, oh, this is bad. Honestly, I think a lot of that fear of the blank page, and I think a lot of writer's block, is really you getting in the way of yourself and being too intimidated. And this is sort of tied with what I was saying before about being a little bit too much of a people pleaser. I have a really punishing perfectionism streak in me where I've had it since I was a kid. It basically has made me very self-conscious and shy my entire life. And I've only, as I've gotten older, figured out how to confront and deal with it for the most part. But I would get so intimidated whenever I would try to start a new book that eventually I just started writing the first couple chapters of each book out by hand. Because similar to what I was saying before about how writing Brightly Woven for my friend took the pressure off and made writing feel fun again.
Yeah.
When you're writing something in a journal, no one but you gets to see the journal. It's sort of tricking your brain. Maybe this won't work for everyone, but it works for me.
It removes all this responsibility and this pressure off of your shoulders, for sure. I can see that. No, that's a great tip. I can see a lot of listeners utilizing that and probably going out to buy their Moleskin notebooks.
I have a notebook for every single project. And actually, whenever I feel really pressured, for instance, this is the most amazing thing that has ever happened to me in my career. I was asked to write an adaptation of Star Wars A New Hope for 8 to 12 year olds. I felt so much pressure, having grown up with Star Wars and loving it so much, being such a massive fan. I wrote that entire book out by hand, and I never do that, but it was because I could not deal with the pressure of sitting down at the computer and actually typing it out. I don't know what it is about it, but I hope that works for some people. Don't be discouraged.
Oh, thank you. I love that.
Sometimes you really just need to trick your brain into switching to writing by hand or changing to different writing locations. Anything to kind of disrupt this mental gridlock that you have and try to unclench your creativity.
I can feel that. Like, it makes me feel like I can just sit down and write endlessly, you know? So we have a listener question from Megan LaCroix. First of all, she loves your work, and she was wondering if you're a plotter or a pantser, and if you do plot, how detailed is your process?
I started off as a total pantser. I honestly feel like people who take a lot of creative writing classes probably know this from the beginning, having taken actual classes, that outlining is actually kind of crucial. Some form of outlining is really what's going to shape the story for you, and you're never going to feel like, oh, what comes next if you put the thought into it beforehand. Mm-hmm. And one thing I always stress is that you're not married to your outline. For me personally, I write a very loose outline for the most part. And I've been kind of experimenting with writing a more detailed outline with each book that I write. For instance, when I wrote Passenger, it had to be super detailed because time travel involves a lot of paradox. Everything ripples out to everything else. So I really needed to have a very tight grip on the story in order to write it. And same with its sequel, Wayfarer. But like with the Darkest Mind series, I knew the big beats of the story, and usually the big emotional beats, almost more than the plot beats. And I gave myself the freedom of figuring out as I was writing how they got from point A to point B, how they got between those different big emotional beats. For every book I write, I can't start writing unless I know how the story's going to end, because I like to build in a lot of red herrings, and I like to build in irony and a little clues if you're really paying attention about how the story's going to go, kind of little signals to the reader that they maybe don't pick up on until they get to the ending. Stuff like that is really fun for me. So that can really only be accomplished for me if I outline. It's become kind of a mix. And most of the writers I know and are friends with, we all have fallen into the same pattern of having a general overall sense of the story, knowing the big major turning points. You know, that's sometimes all you need. And then giving ourselves the freedom to get between all of those different points and come up with a better idea. I love that feeling where you are writing and writing and writing, and then you think you know how something's going to go, and a thought pops into your head, line of dialogue or a twist or a way to really elevate a moment. And you're like, yes, thank you, muse. Thank you, brain. I never get those lightning ideas when I sit down to develop a story, but I do get shower ideas when I'm working on books. And I love walking. I guess I'm like a Regency heroine in that I like love to go for these long brainstorming walks, which is now much harder to do because I live in a desert climate.
Oh,
and
no.
It's like 120 degrees.
You should carry around an umbrella, an AC cooler, portable one.
Desert living, man.
Oh, yes. Thank you for that. I love that. And that was really helpful. Can I throw in one more listener question?
Of course.
Thank you. This one is from Catherine Cho, and she loves your work as well. She is a fan of your books, and she knows you've written your different books and series, Brightly Woven, Darkest Minds, and Passenger. She's wondering about your idea process. I love that you already mentioned that you have a different notebook for each and every story idea that you have. Catherine specifically would like to know, do you have an idea book? And also, do you get inspired by the world around you? And or do you use real life experiences to find that inspiration?
Good question. I love talking about ideas because I think they come from so many different places. I don't tend to start unless I know I'm really committing to a project. It's almost like when you get married and you put the ring on. That's me, when I start a new notebook for a story, that's when I'm really making a commitment to it. And I'm going to sit down and really brainstorm it out and keep all of my notes together and keep all of the handwritten pages in one place. A lot of people I know just from answering Tumblr asks or Twitter questions or talking to readers at events, people get really tripped up when they're working on a project. You know, it's going well, and then they get an idea, and it's so shiny and so cool, mm-hmm. and it's so tempting. And really, the only way, don't stop writing what you're currently writing. The only time I ever really want to be working on something else is when I'm in the middle of writing a current book and it's not going fast, or I'm struggling with something, and the temptation to abandon that project is so high. But the only way, you can't fix a book that doesn't exist. So the only way is to actually finish the book that you're working on. So whenever I get a shiny idea, that's me trying to shimmy on back out of the hard project I'm currently entrenched in. I'll just open up a Word document and I'll quickly write down all of the thoughts that I have about it, or like the basic idea or the line that popped into my head or what. And then I save it in my proposals folder that's on my desktop.
Oh, I like that. Organized.
It's useless if you can't find it.
Yeah, that's true.
You know what I mean?
That's true.
This has happened to me so many times where I'm like, can I email that to myself? I didn't use the subject line, so this is going to be tough. I was joking about this on Twitter, but I always get ideas right before I fall asleep. When I'm in bed, sometimes to relax, if my brain is going like 1,000 miles an hour, I will listen to music while I'm in bed. And it sometimes helps me brainstorm an idea for a scene, or if I'm listening to the same song over and over again. This is actually, now that I'm saying this out loud, is not that useful in shutting down a busy brain. But I'll listen to a song over and over again and try to plan out a scene that I'm going to write tomorrow, or I'll handwrite that scene out in my notebook I keep by my bed. But I also have started, when I'm really sleepy, I will just pick up my phone and write a note for myself. Mm. And so the other day, I opened up my notes and I have no recollection of writing these notes in here.
What?
I just opened it and read them to you. So I think I wrote them. I don't know if this is the author version of sleepwalking, where you're like
sleep writing. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I think autocorrect maybe stepped in here. So the notes that I found were, the door's defying, she has to take care of her sister, handlebars gone, swordless killer gone out, why? By planet proxies. I have no idea what any of that means. I think proxies was a term I wanted to use in an idea I'm brainstorming right now. It must have been largely autocorrect.
I wonder if there's a way to switch off autocorrect so you can try to figure out what the word that you were trying to say originally was.
No, it's kind of a mystery. I mean, my ideas really do come from everywhere. They sometimes will just occur to me. Sometimes I'll be reading something or watching something and I'll think, oh, this twist that they tried to do would be better if XYZ happened instead. So I'll take like the structure of that scene versus, you know, lifting that exact scene. It'll like spark something that I want to try or do. But I also pull a lot from history, which was obviously the basis of Passenger and Wayfarer, was a lot of history and a lot of research. But even in The Darkest Minds, for instance, the kids who develop these crazy powers of the mind, they're in what's called in the series rehabilitation camps, which are very loosely based on the Japanese internment camps that were in the United States during World War II and the conditions there. I'm not trying to appropriate that experience. There are so many interesting people in history, too. I talk about this a lot in relation to Hamilton the musical, which is amazing.
I have not watched it. I really want to. I'm slightly jealous. I haven't. I know I suck.
I'm so jealous of you that you get to experience it for the first time.
That's so sweet.
I'm so excited for you. I wish I could go back and relive that moment. Because like I was saying before, I was just your average 16-year-old girl who was super obsessed with the Founding Fathers for no reason whatsoever in high school. I wrote my college admissions essay on George Washington. It was next level obsession. What I found so interesting about that period were the personalities, and I liked the ironies and the sad contrast where you have George Washington, who is the leader of our country's independence, and yet he owns slaves. Like, there's a lot of really complicated aspects of humanity that are just personified by what was going on during that era and the people who are fighting with each other to form our country. And so I'm relating this to Hamilton because Lin-Manuel Miranda talked about this too, where when he was reading the biography on Alexander Hamilton, it felt like Hamilton had reached out through history and kind of grabbed him. And I think Lin-Manuel Miranda was responding to was just the personalities and how interesting they were, and kind of tying them to everything that's been happening today and how history reverberates to the present. And you see this almost this great churning tide where history marches forward and then it'll regress and it'll march forward again. And I think it's really interesting to tie what was happening at the founding of the country to what's happening today. And politics right now is so contentious, and thank God we're almost to the election so we can all rediscover our chill again and justly have fine time of it. But anyway, so I think history is an amazing resource, especially when it comes to personalities and dynamics. Like, I've always really wanted to write a story that sort of emulated the relationship between the frenemyship between Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton, about how these two very strong personalities who come from very opposite backgrounds rise together and how they clash along the way before ultimately repelling one another. I don't know. I really love writing about different types of relationships and different relationship dynamics, whether that's in families or friendships or enemies or frenemies. So there's inspiration everywhere. I know that's such a cliche answer.
No, but it's so true.
I love talking to my mom and my aunts and uncles about their backgrounds and their history growing up and what their family members were like that I never got to meet, and kind of mining little inside jokes from my family and putting them in books that only my family will ever get. For instance, a book I just finished my first revision on is a middle grade that's set in Massachusetts around Halloween.
Oh, is this the Last 13 Nights?
Yeah, although I think we're changing the title.
Oh, okay.
I think it's going to be something to the effect of The Dreadful Tale of Prosper Redding.
Okay. So, and it's coming out fall 2017?
I think so, like fall or late summer.
Okay.
I'm not totally sure yet.
Okay, so 2017 though.
Yeah, so okay. Next year.
We'll look out for it.
Yeah, and it was so fun to write this voice, and I got to talk to my mom a lot about it because she and her family lived in Lowell, Massachusetts, and she would tell us these stories that made me think New England, or in really Massachusetts, was like this enormous graveyard of gray despair and mist and fog. She had a lot of kids in her neighborhood die in really odd ways.
What?
While they were growing up. And
like, can you give us an example? Like, what do you mean by odd? Now I'm getting creeped out. I have goosebumps again. Oh my God.
In retrospect now, I'm like, why did you tell us these stories? One kid, really cautionary tales, I guess, to ensure we would never try any of this stuff. So one kid died because they were playing hide and seek and he got locked inside of an unplugged refrigerator
in the garage,
and they couldn't hear him. It was an old-fashioned refrigerator, I guess, that for some reason he could not get it open. So they found his body in there. My mom just tells these stories very casually.
Oh my God.
Another kid, or maybe teenager, was riding his bike down a hill and his wheel hit a rock, and it was right by, I don't know if it was a graveyard, if it was just one of those really old iron fences with the sharp points at the top, and he basically fell onto the fence and it like went up under his chin and he died. Yeah, a lot of stories like that.
It's so haunted. Oh my God. I don't even want to mess with that.
It's my mom's family, and well, not really her family, because this family in the story is very Kennedy-esque, but just sort of that atmosphere and hearing her stories and her love of Halloween have really informed this little book. So really find what excites you. Find something you do want to research. The reason why Passenger is set a large part in 1776 is because I love studying that time and knew a lot about it and felt comfortable writing in it, possibly because that was one of my past lives.
Thank you for sharing that. My God, I'm like still creeped out about your mom's stories. Jeez, what?
Every once in a while, she'll like pull a story out of the vault that'll really stun me. For instance, she didn't tell me until I was in high school that I was almost kidnapped as a baby. We were at the Arizona State Fair. I was, I think, like 18 months old. I have an older sister who's 2 years older than me. So my sister, my mom, and I were walking along. I was in a stroller. And we were looking at the different vendor booths. And my mom had unbuckled me from the stroller because she, I guess, had wanted to carry me for a little while. And my sister reached up to pull a princess crown down off of the rack. So my mom had to kind of maneuver around the stroller to catch it before it fell on her. And they were trying to ride it. And out of the corner of her eye, she noticed that the stroller had tipped back because of the diaper bag being around the handle.
Yeah.
And so she turned and she just saw this woman booking it through the crowd of the fair. And the worst part of the story is that my mom is chasing after this woman, and my dad and my grandmother are standing nearby like, what's going on?
Oh my God.
And my mom is screaming, she stole my baby, she took my baby, she took my baby. And no one left her. The only reason she got me back was because the exit at the fair bottlenecked. And she said I didn't even start crying until she ripped me out of this woman's arms. The dark side of the story, it's okay to joke about now that I'm fine, obviously, but the dark side of the story is like what the Coconino County police told my mom afterwards, which if you hadn't caught up to her, they would have cut off her hair and they would have taken her across the border and you never would have seen her again. So it probably was that kind of a situation.
Oh my God, are you freaking kidding me?
And then we never went back to the state fair.
Holy shit.
Yeah, it was so creepy. And so obviously my mom did not tell me this when I was younger because it probably would have made me afraid of everything.
Yeah, it would have made you extremely paranoid and fearful of everything. Oh my God, Alex, I'm so glad that your mom saved you.
I know, I could have been the face on the milk carton.
Seriously, okay? I'm like, girl, you need to write a story about that.
I know. She wasn't being a neglectful parent or anything. It really was like a split second where she turned her back to help my sister and someone took advantage of it and clearly had been kind of following her or watching. They never found that woman, I don't think, because she really just faded back and was like, oh, I thought she was lost, and then like disappeared, and my mom was trying to make sure I was okay.
You need to write an autobiography because I'm pretty sure it's gonna be made into a movie. This is insane.
It'll start with the fact that I was born in the hallway with no doctors and nurses around. That was another story my mom pulled out of nowhere. She was like, I was by myself. I told them you were coming. And then the nurse came back and there you were. I know.
The water broke really fast or something? Like, what?
I was my mom's second baby. Sometimes second babies come on much faster. The labor can be much shorter. My mom was really telling them, yeah, I'm going to have a baby. You have to get me into a delivery room. But I think all the delivery rooms were full. So she was like, I feel like I didn't even like have to push. There you were.
Okay, good for your mama. At least less pain, you know?
But this is like tying back to the Greek witches in my family. My mother's grandmother, Yaya, had 13 children and gave birth to a baby Breach at home and then got up a couple hours later and cleaned the house. So really has a high pain tolerance. I did not inherit.
If I just gave birth, I'll be like, y'all bitches can do the housework. I am not doing shit. I am sleeping for the next 6 months. I don't care. Oh my gosh, your grandma's so badass.
It's crazy. Those are some deep cuts from the Alex Bracken archive.
Damn, I love that. Thank you for sharing that. It just shows like you're from a line of badasses. That's so cool.
I mean, this is really what I mean, is there are a lot of little events in life that you kind of dismiss or don't think about. Yeah. They're really ripe for storytelling and using those experiences in your own life and trying to track back to how you felt in those moments or how the people involved in them felt. So really, inspiration is everywhere, including attempted kidnappings.
My God, I cannot believe all those stories just came out in this one conversation. I love it so much. I feel so honored and so grateful that you were sharing this with us.
My mom grew up in the housing projects. She's a really tough lady. She fought a mugger off at knife point. She didn't want to give up her Elton John tickets in her purse that she had worked so hard and saved up for.
Oh my God, dude, I know, mom is so fierce, dude. I love her. I want to meet your mama. Definitely gets it from her mom. I mean, just giving birth, getting up right after that.
I have a couple great aunts who are still alive. Just these like old Greek ladies. They're just amazing. So I've done the genealogy of both my mom's side and my dad's side just because I was really curious. And it's fascinating. It's so interesting. My dad's not Greek. Parts of his family have actually been in America since the 17th century, so like the 1600s. And then other parts of his family came over from Germany.
That's where you get Bracken from. Okay. I was just saying, because Bracken doesn't sound Greek at all.
I think it's English.
Okay, gotcha. I was like, I couldn't pinpoint. It sounds really American.
Parts of his family have been in America forever. This is why you should do your genealogy, so you can one day be on a podcast and share a cool fact. Because I share a common ancestor with George Washington and Queen Elizabeth.
What?
Yeah.
You are full of amazing stories.
And you know what's crazier? Like what we were saying earlier about past lives, like a lot of my dad's family was in Virginia.
I buy it. That's awesome.
My mom's paternal side is English and her mother's side is very Greek. Someone on her side was the basis for the Sherlock Holmes story, The Hounds of Baskerville.
What?
this guy that was apparently so evil in his village that when he died, they like an iron fence and buried him under a bunch of heavy stones because they were so afraid he was going to walk the earth and torment them. So sometimes you find some not so amazing things about your family lineage.
I'm telling you, you will never run out of story ideas. You will never run out of them.
I encourage people enough. Do your family history. Do it. Gift for your parents one day. It's really cool. Ever since my dad passed away, I've been looking for ways to feel close to him. So like that's one way I feel close to him and feel close to all of these people in my family I've never had the opportunity to meet. But like it makes you feel very connected to the world and connected to history.
And it's bigger than just you. It's a whole universe. Yeah. We're all connected. That's such a great idea, by the way, just talking about story ideas to do that as well, just like spark some inspiration.
Yeah. And I can do my mom's Greek side, though, because they were from such a rural village in Greece that I think the church with all the records burned down and I also cannot read or write Greek. So that becomes a little more complicated. It gives me chills to look at passenger lists when my mom's family came over through Ellis Island. My sister and I visited Ellis Island when I still lived in New York, and then we found my grandfather Theodore's name. It took us a while because they did not spell his last name correctly. History gets a bad rep, but it's full of really lively, wonderful characters and also great inspiration for antagonists and a better understanding of how to do world building just in terms of how interconnected politics and faith and the economy all is.
What was the name of that genealogy? Was it a website?
I went through ancestry.com, and kind of the amazing thing about it now is that so many people have done their family trees that Ancestry can like help you connect. They're like, oh, this person that you found had these children. Which one are you? So many people have done it now that it helps you align your own family tree. And you kind of have to double check to make sure.
It's like, wait, who's this cousin? This is not my cousin.
It's like so many weird last names.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to check out Ancestry. Alex, I would love to know, what was your hardest scene, the most challenging scene that you had to write out of all your books, and why? And how did you finally get yourself out of that?
There are two ways to answer this question, I think. A complicated scene versus an emotionally trying scene. What immediately came to mind just now was that I had a really hard time writing Olive Never Fade because I had to finish that book right after my dad passed away. So it was a lot of sitting at my computer and just like crying and crying and crying while I was writing this book.
No.
So I feel very emotionally connected to Never Fade. And actually the hardest emotional scene that I've ever written is in Never Fade. I don't want to spoil it, just to give people who've read this series a better sense. It's when Ruby finally gets caught by a skip tracer and is about to be brought into custody. In my mind, that is the manifestation of all of her fears about her being a monster, about her never being accepted in society, etc. So that scene really got me. That's one of the few scenes that I've legitimately cried while writing, just because I was so upset on Ruby's behalf. To answer the other side of that question, Wayfarer just about killed me. I will be totally upfront with you guys. That book was the most complicated, hardest book I've ever written. There were several times where I just got up out of my office chair and laid face down on the floor. You know, sometimes it's a wonderful, wonderful feeling when a book just pours out of you and you feel very connected to it and you totally understand every part of it. But this book, for some reason, was pulling teeth. Like, every single thing was like, do you want to do this? Nope. This like flies in the face of this rule you established in book one. You want to do this? Can't do that because of this other rule, or like these characters can't meet yet, or this does not flow logically. So Wayfarer, for some reason, it really wasn't until the round of edits I did just before line edits that book finally really clicked for me. I think what I was really actually struggling with was that I didn't understand what the emotional arc of that book was. And then once I figured it out, once it occurred, it became so much easier to kind of see through the fog that I had been trapped inside. So for me, when writing is a struggle, it's usually because there's something broken in the book and my perfectionist tendencies doesn't want to address it. You know, it's all tied to fear of failure. The book's going to be bad. I don't know how to fix it. I need help, but my editor doesn't quite know how to fix it either. And like, we're brainstorming back and forth, and what if it's never good? So I think with Wayfarer, what ended up happening was that there felt like a lot of pressure to follow up to Passenger, which amazingly, still cannot believe it, debuted at number one in the New York Times list.
Huge congrats.
And thank you. But it's such an interesting book. I mean, I'll be totally upfront with you that I've never written a book that was so polarizing before. So some people really love Passenger and other people do not love it. And I think that sort of hinges on if you love history and if you're willing to kind of slowly enter a world and really explore it versus if you need like a really plot-driven story, which is what The Darkest Minds was. Once I figured, there was like a lot of that in the back of my mind where I was constantly second guessing myself with Wayfair. So really, I will say the hardest scene I've ever written is every single scene in Wayfair.
Well, you know what? You did it for the fans, so I'm sure they're very grateful.
Like it. If you don't like it, don't tweet it at me or don't tag me on Instagram. My little hearts just shrivel and die.
I'm sure they love it. Trust. I mean, just seeing how excited the listeners were just to hear that you're going to be on the show. Oh my gosh, are you kidding? They would never.
Thank you. That makes me so happy. It's so funny because I always say like different strokes for different folks. Some people will love Passenger but hate The Darkest Minds, and some people love The Darkest Minds but didn't like Passenger. Some people like both. There are absolutely no hard feelings. For me, what I really struggle with is the feeling that I've let a reader down. They were so excited to read something and then I wasted their time or didn't live up to their expectations. Again, it's that horrible perfectionist gridlock that you get into in your mind. You immediately equate it to failure when someone doesn't like your book. Even though I learned years and years and years ago when I worked as an editorial assistant that reading is so subjective. Everyone has such different tastes. It's a crazy ride where I'm so glad I have writer friends who can talk me down when I get myself worked up that like, oh, everyone's going to hate this book or, oh, I'm never going to figure this book out. That's why it's so important to find critique partners or to have writing friends. You guys can do that service for each other and really talk through what you're going through, because writing is such a solitary endeavor and there's so many weird aspects of it where it's sort of a, I call it like a public private life where mm-hmm. you have a public face, and now that the internet is here, you can connect with your readers, which is amazing, but it also means you're getting all of the negative voices too. And Aaron, Susan, and I have like a term for it. I think the three of us all look at the Instagram posts we've been tagged in, because if someone takes the time to post something about your book on Instagram, I always want to like it. Like I always want to go in and like thank them and just be like, this is amazing. But sometimes people will do a beautiful picture and then write an awful thing about the book. Don't do that.
Yeah, that's really not nice. If you have nothing nice to say, just don't say it at all. I definitely agree with that.
You know, authors are grown-ups in theory. Most of us can take it. 360 days of the year, I'm totally fine with criticism. I can take it. I actually thrive on it because it helps me grow as a writer. And then 5 days out of the year, it just is like, I'm a hack. I'll never write another book. I've known authors who believe in their own innate brilliance and they do not listen to what their editors are saying, or they slowly have started to take less and less notes from critique partners and editors because they think they know their audience so well and what the audience wants, and they don't listen when stores tell them that books need to be shorter in order to actually fit on their shelves, or when foreign publishers are actually, is it possible for you to keep this book down to reasonable size because it takes us so long to translate it and we can't do simultaneous releases. There are so many different people who work on a book that you have to be very respectful of that journey, and you have to listen to all of those voices at the same time for staying true to your vision and what you want to be and how you want your career to go. It's like a weird existence being an author. There are a lot of neuroses involved with it. So if writing is something that you love to do, lean into that. If you lose your joy in writing, even if you're published, like that's when you have to stop and reassess what's actually going on. There are always going to be times, like when I was working on Wayfair, that I would sit down and dread confronting this book that I felt like was so broken throughout most of the time period I was working on it. And I think that comes out on the page. I think if you're really struggling with writing a book, or if you aren't enthusiastic about it, it comes out in the writing itself. Whereas I can always tell when an author was really in love with the story and like wrote it with a ton of energy and enthusiasm. If writing is something that brings you joy and suddenly it's not bringing you joy, I think that's when it's okay to take a step back and reassess. But don't give up on yourself.
I love that. That's amazing. From your experiences writing, do you have any resources that you think would really help a beginner writer?
Yeah, good question. I think, you know, the trick with being in a writing class, whether it's nonfiction or it's an actual creative writing class where it is fiction. Actually, that's unfair to say because I guess nonfiction is also creative writing because every aspect of writing tends to be a little creative. The important thing is to know that when you write, everyone's going to have an opinion, including your professor, your teacher. You can't have such a big ego. You have to believe in yourself. If your goal is to be published, you have to really believe that you will get there with work and with dedication. But you can't have, you know, such a big ego that you reject everyone's advice. But at the same time, you have to learn, and you will, I think, naturally, the more feedback that you get, you have to kind of filter that feedback through, like, what am I actually trying to accomplish in the story? What advice is this person's just like personal preference that they like to read in stories that I'm not going to include just because that's not what I'm trying to achieve here. I think the more you work with critique partners, the more you are involved. Creative writing classes, you learn to filter the criticism and feedback that you're getting, and that's a really important skill to develop. And I think, too, that, oh my gosh, you know, I've never been on a writer's retreat before.
Oh, really?
Never a legitimate writing retreat, which I gotta get on that.
I've heard of other authors doing this where they just rent out a home, Airbnb or something, and they just go away for a weekend and they just all meet up there and everyone just has this nice support system and really positive kind of pressure where it's like everybody's writing, everybody's working on their thing. So you don't feel any FOMO about like missing out on what's happening outside of that world. Everybody else is there working on their craft. So it's so much easier for you to do it too. So it would be something that you can even do on your own and just gather people together, make your own writer's retreat.
The trouble with writer's retreats, and I've tried to arrange a bunch of them. Victoria Aveyard and I and a couple other authors were trying to arrange one. And then we all realized that we're all traveling and we're going to different events. And so I think the key to writer's retreats is that we have to schedule them out far in advance so we can turn down other things in order to do the writer's retreat. And we're all kind of on different deadline schedules. Sometimes they align, sometimes they don't. So not that that really matters, because I think it's useful to be working in a group where someone is brainstorming, someone is like drafting, and you're just all bouncing ideas off of each other. In terms of resources, there are so many resources online right now. I'm actually pretty jealous, because I feel like when I started out in 2005, basically, the internet and even the Kidlit community is not at all what it is today. And there's so many authors who give free advice in their newsletter. I give free advice in my newsletter all the time. Susan Dennard, who I mentioned before, has amazing resources on her site, worksheets, strategies. She talks a lot about the importance of writing rhythms and sort of coming up with a schedule for yourself. So her website, susandennard.com, is amazing. Beth Revis also is another author who commits so much of her time to creating writing resources and guides. So there's a ton of free stuff online if you're in the financial situation where you can't just go out and buy a million craft books. One of the biggest things you can do, you need feedback, whether that's you need someone validating you saying, you know what, this is actually great, keep going, and that helps you maintain your enthusiasm. Or you need someone to be like, whoa, whoa, whoa. No author sets out to write something that's offensive or appropriates another culture's mythology. Sometimes you drift into that because you're not being as thoughtful as you should be while writing. And sometimes you need another outside pair of eyes to say, to flag something as potentially being problematic that you never, ever, ever would have meant to put in. So really, I think what I'm trying to say is if you can, try to find people online through Twitter, through different writing website boards. Try to hook up with other people who are writing. Like, try to find an online writing group. Or if you and your friends at school, if you're in college or if you're in high school or even middle school, definitely try to form a writing group. Try to seek out people within the English department at colleges. Talk to your English teachers in high school. See if they know of anyone else. And trade your work. You become a stronger writer when you could critique other people's work as well, because you're thinking analytically and you're analyzing the work that they've done and you're spotting areas for them to improve. Editing and drafting are two different muscles. I'm a terrible editor. I feel like I'm an okay writer. Another reason I knew I should not be an editorial assistant. I was not very good at editing. I just had very strong opinions about things. And basically, you know, really flex your editing muscle, because that can only help you as a writer too. So I hope that's okay advice.
Are you kidding? Was that okay? That was brilliant advice.
You know what? Also, check out your independent bookstore, because I feel like if your indie doesn't already have a group like this, sometimes they'll do like teen advisory or they'll do YA book clubs. I think that's another way of finding people who you can eventually trade work with if you trust them and who you like and you're into the same sort of stories. Or you can ask your local indie if you can start one of those groups. And I think they would love that. Indies are so community oriented, which is one of the reasons why they're so amazing. So really reach out. It takes a lot of guts and courage to reach out and show your work to someone when you feel like it's not quite ready yet, or it's exposing your heart in a way because you're so hard on it. So be brave. You're brave if you're already writing. Be brave in being willing to show your work to someone to help improve it and to make it the best it can possibly be.
And that wraps up our interview with the incredible Alex Bracken. Alex, thank you again for such an amazing conversation. I absolutely loved it and could have gone on with you for hours more. Listeners, thank you as always for listening in. I know a lot of you are massive fans of Alex's work, so this episode is especially dedicated to you. Please say hi to Alex over on Twitter at Alex Bracken. For a list of all the books and resources she mentions in her episode, be sure to head over to her show notes page at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Alex Bracken. If you guys have read any of Alex's books, please leave a review about it on Amazon or Goodreads. If you haven't checked out her books, please pick up a copy to show your support. One last thing before we end today's episode. A lot of you have reached out asking about writing communities and classes. If you're working on your own children's book, anything from a picture book to young adult novel, I'd love for you to listen to what Gotham has to offer. At Gotham, you learn from teachers who are accomplished writers and are amazing at teaching. Through lectures, writing exercises, and workshops, you learn how to enter the psyche of young people with a grown-up sense of craftsmanship. Gotham teaches writers all the elements of craft in a way that best resonates with young readers, and better yet, you'll learn how to entertain and enlighten young minds. On top of making progress on your work, Gotham also introduces you to the ways of the business. They've put a lot of time and effort into creating a safe and structured environment for writers to learn for over 20 years. Be sure to head over to 88cupsoftea.com/Gotham Writers to check out their classes. They have a super supportive staff that will help you find the course that's perfect for you. Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye!